Okay, and we're back. So as you were saying, who you are, your business, what you do.
Yeah, so I'm Megan McWade. I am a tailor, and I own Shop and Tailor Studios. It's been around for 8.5 years. It once upon a time was a tailoring shop, and lots of people would come in with their clothes for repairs and alterations and tailoring lots of custom work. And then in the pandemic, I switched it to a maker space as a pivot for survival. And now me and my friend Shanti, we also started a second business together, but we also work at Chop and Tailor Studios together. And yeah, we rent out to makers, both professional and hobbyists, who need access to a facility for sewing and creation. We also host a bunch of events, fun social activities, craft events, pinning parties. I'm in the midst of discussing a clothing swap soon, which would be really cool. And yeah, we cater very closely to the queer community as well. Lots of gender talk and clothing talk and stuff like that.
That's amazing. What's a clothing swap?
A clothing swap. Very exciting and very chaotic. But basically, you go through your wardrobe and a bunch of stuff that you're not interested in wearing anymore, doesn't really suit or align your style, and you need to make room for something else. It's basically getting rid of the clothes that you don't want in your closet anymore, and then you bring a swap with a bunch of other people who are doing the same thing, and you just kind of trade clothes, and it's like, yeah, it's an opportunity to just like let go of a bunch of stuff you don't need anymore. And then if there's anything else that someone has, like someone else's treasures, yeah, you just kind of trade them. And either you like stuff that's there or you don't. It's just kind of a fun way to explore fashion without having to spend any money. And then it's also a very sustainable option for like the cycle of clothing. So your clothing isn't necessarily just going directly into the trash if you don't want it anymore. You have the opportunity to give those clothes further lives with new lovers, essentially.
That is really cool. So, actually, do you want to share where you guys are located?
Yeah, Shop and Tailor Studios is right at the corner of College and Ossington. We're on Ossington. It's 428 Ossington. We're the basement suite. We have a nice, giant studio here, which is really great. Yeah, lots of space, lots of cool little corners of tools and supplies and working spaces and stuff.
That's amazing. So before we get started, I always like to ask, I'm not sure if you have something with you to drink, but if you do, are you drinking anything?
No, but I have an empty cup here. I can pretend.
An empty cup. Okay. We love it. An empty cup is perfect. For myself, this is really, I like to share. It's called Sapsucker. It's a little organic sparkling tree water from Canada.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so that's just something interesting there. But
it's like a maple syrup kind of thing?
I think it's actually from a maple tree.
Like, okay, cool. Before they like boil it down for syrup?
Yeah, I guess so. I've never actually tried it, but that's interesting. That's cool. It's very mapley. But yeah. So let's Canadian. Get. Honestly, it's the most Canadian thing I've ever drank. That's so funny. But yeah, let's get right into it. Sure. I think that, so for people that don't know, Megan and I, we met through the LEAD conference, which was an entrepreneurship conference done by a club that I'm at. You were a part of our panel, did a phenomenal job.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. It was really great to hear all the other panelists' perspective on things, too. It's just like as educational to be a part of it as I hope it was to be attending it.
Yeah, I heard a lot of awesome feedback. And what I was wondering was, how was it for you? Like, was that your first ever panel to be a part of?
No, I have been a part of business entrepreneur panels at TMU in the past. And my experience was also very similar in it was really exciting to meet the other panelists and the diversity of businesses on the same panel being asked the same questions. The opportunity for connection and offering inspiration and insight to people who are at a much earlier phase in their ideas.
Yeah.
It was my second panel at TMU. I've also done a panel at George Brown for their students on sustainability and fashion, which was really, really insightful and really fun. The questions that are asked are always really like exciting, new ideas. I think it's really important to have panels and just a variety of questions being asked, because sometimes I don't ask myself the questions he said, so it's a good prompt for me too.
Yeah, I feel like that open discussion can foster so much growth even within yourself, and it makes you think of things that you may have not thought of, like you were just saying, and reflect on interesting ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. One, funny enough, one question that was asked of me like at one of the panels a long time ago was before the pandemic. And one of the questions was, have you ever had to pivot your business and why? And all, then sure enough, like a year later, it was like, wow, good thing that question was asked. And I had been thinking about it. It was like it's an important thing within business and longevity and stuff like that, where you never know what the hell is going to be on the horizon, or as the city landscape changes, or as economy evolves, or even you as a person evolve, things within your business need to change with that. And the word pivot is, you know, something that is important. But I was not anticipating how big of a word that was going to be and the significance of it in the nearish future.
Yeah, I can only imagine the stress that you faced during the pandemic. And how was that kind of, did you see kind of events play out leading up to that point of, oh, I need to change something and I need to pivot?
I would say, like, so I think that you've asked sort of like a two-part question. Like the stress of the pandemic was extraordinary, and it still is. Like the degree of the lockdowns and stuff is over, but the hangover of what has happened still exists. So we're still all navigating the outcome of what's happened. And then on the other side of things, I was in like a burnout phase leading up to the pandemic. So I was like pretty burnt out leading up to that. And I knew that some things needed to evolve in order to match how my life was evolving as well. And so I was considering like how things needed to change. And then the pandemic really like escalated what change needed to be and a direction of change. Like I knew some things needed to change, but I didn't know where they were going to go. And the degree of stress and strain really helped to like find the pathway, which was a long journey, an exciting journey, and an absolutely terrifying journey all at the same time.
Yeah. In the pandemic, I mean, obviously you experienced it firsthand, but from what I saw online, it was that, for especially small businesses, it was just like trying to stay afloat and keep your head above water. And so were there any things that you tried to focus on doing within your own business to kind of make sure you were able to get through it?
I think like the mental care was like consistency, finding routine and finding like a purpose each day. And something to work towards. I think that's something as like an entrepreneur, as like a doer, I know a lot of people also feel this as well, as like when you feel like you don't have a purpose, it feels really, you feel really lost. And so I was putting a lot of time into mapping out like, okay, we're here now. What do I imagine like 5 weeks from now could be, and how can I be working towards something? So I was often creating some sort of plan to work towards, so I had something important to be doing with my time. Like, how do I take advantage of this, the conditions and the situation that I am in?
Yeah.
How do I max out the opportunity? Like, how do we spin it? Like, how do I look at this as if it's an opportunity in a weird way?
Yeah.
It's very hard to do that. but I was really working hard on that, and But at the same time, like, you know, the next 2 days could suddenly be like full on lockdown. You could get ticketed if you're outside. It was like finding purpose, but then also just sitting quietly like a waiting duck. It was confusing. It was a lot. It was unpredictable, and it lasted a really long time.
Yeah,
and it was like financially very hard. Pinching pennies was like a massive, massive thing. So, what else can I say about surviving the logistics of the pandemic? Sometimes it's like kind of had to like let go of the wheel and just see the free fall as it was going to be. Some parts of it was like, I was like overworking, like trying to build up and compensate for what our losses were. Mm-hmm. And I was working like too hard, and then it would kind of not be worth it because lockdowns would just like wipe things clean anyway. So that was really hard. And eventually I abandoned some of those pivot ideas and found our way to Makerspace over time. That helps answer.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That was a lot, but I think that's amazing. And I'm really happy and thankful that you were able to get through it. Cause I know I saw a lot of businesses fall, family owned, pop-up shops, all that. And it was awful to see. And then all the big guys, all the corporations, they're just riding up high and happy all the time. And it sucks.
Yeah. The disproportionate spread. I think the mental load and emotional load on small businesses is extraordinary. Like the thing with big corporate companies is that they're sharing the load across so many people.
Yeah.
And like how many people work for that company? How many people are being shifted to come up with ideas? Like you have your idea farm, right? And you have all these employees. Like, what are we doing? How can we ask the people that we already have on staff? And companies that have like hundreds, if not thousands of employees, the overhead that can drop when you let go of a lot of people can be high. You can drop your expenditures quickly. Where small businesses like your retail shops or your convenience stores or your restaurants, the overhead operational costs are still the majority, the majority costs. So even if you do downsize your staff, your costs are still high. It's like managing that that balance of cash flow. The stress is a lot harder, and the whole mental load is on such a small selection of individuals. And I think that I like really, that was the biggest thing, you know, like someone who wears all the hats of their small business, every single problem is under every single one of those hats, and you feel it all day and you take it home with you because that is how you sleep. That is how you eat. That is how you take care of your family, all these things. So I think that mental load, emotional load was like extremely detrimental to a lot of people's ability to power through and continue. It's not
easy. I can imagine. I can only imagine, really. And I think it's amazing that you're talking about, you know, I find that balance and mental health as a whole, because that's something I love to talk about and open up about and kind of break down that wall. And in the pandemic, something that, and I'm sure you heard as well, it was like hashtag buy local, or just focus on supporting small businesses. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I especially did because to me, it's like what you do, you're what we need to support, your business, your vision. And
thank you.
Yeah, of course. I think it's amazing, truly. And I think it's incredible, you know, the amount of risk you take on and the amount of mental stress. And like you said, how when you take your work home with you, especially when it's a small operation, have you found a way to kind of separate your home from your work?
I think there's a couple things that I have done in my life. I don't have a computer at home.
Okay.
It's like kind of a crazy thing to think about because everyone has like an iPad or some kind of like,
yeah,
right? And I I don't. I think I'm like so, I get so sick and I just, I can't work anymore at the end of the day. And I just go home and I watch TV and I eat like snacks or whatever. So I don't even bring home the opportunity to do any work. Like I just can't do it. Mm-hmm. And I also do not own a, I don't have anything sewing related at my house. Like people okay. come over if I have a party and someone's button falls off, they're like SOL, like I can't help them. But meanwhile, I'm like the most qualified person everywhere. I go to sew something for someone and I just don't have, I don't have the supplies. So it's like my life as a tailor, like it doesn't exist in my own house, which I find funny, but it does really draw that line in the sand. And then another thing that I have been leaning a lot into in the last number of years is, which is like really hard for entrepreneurs, people totally burn out and that whole hustle culture, which was a topic mm-hmm. we did discuss a lot in the panel when we met, mm-hmm. Is like allowing myself to have a break and giving myself permission to stop. And it's like a conversation of consent that I have to have with myself, a very active conversation of consent. Mm-hmm. And a way that I've learned to sort of practice that is in therapy. If you've ever done therapy, highly recommend it. But an exercise that's really good is it's called like the chair exercise, where you have two chairs, you sit in one and you have a conversation with yourself, and then you sit in the other chair and you reply. So you're like, you're talking to yourself as if you're actually giving advice to a friend. And the way that you talk to a friend is can be so much more frank and so much more direct and so much more real than mm-hmm. you can really talk to yourself. And you can have a lot more compassion for this person as a human and as their limits and boundaries and max capacities when mm-hmm. you kind of take a step back and you see them as an isolated person. And you're allowed to do that for yourself. And so I think that type of permission is a type of work that I have been doing with myself, and it has really benefited me and allows me the opportunity for recharge. So I recharge at home without all these things. And then when I come back to the studio each day, my opportunity to be more productive, to be more present, to think clearer, to have higher brain function is that much better because I've actually rested. Those kinds of wow. things.
I love that. I love both of those. The no computer, when you said that, I had like a mental jaw drop. I'm like, what?
What?
But I think that's awesome. And it's
computer. Yeah. I imagine so many people like, I cannot do that. I need my computer attached to my hip, which is like, you do technically. Like, I still yeah. have one, you know, but.
Yeah. I was going to say like, no phone either, but.
I wish. I do wish I didn't have my phone, but. Not that intense, but not having a computer, like I don't do any like mm-hmm. administration from mm-hmm. home.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah.
And the chair, it's practice. I think that is so cool and so creative. Is that like you're physically, you have two chairs and you're moving in between them, or is it more just in your own head?
Well, you can do both. Like I would say if you're starting out this practice, having two physical chairs really helps. It helps understand the practice and the shift of space and the shift of body, kind of like it's enough of a jostle to jump. I started doing that kind of work with my therapist like a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And I just found it so beneficial. And then another way I've done the same practice is it's like nerve wracking and very vulnerable, but it's like if you do it alone in your bedroom or something, mm-hmm. is like video recording yourself telling your own story and then watching your story back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Like hearing your own voice say things that maybe you wouldn't be able to say out loud to another person, or like just admitting things in the like comfort of a private space.
Yeah.
It helps you like work through some ideas that you didn't really maybe know that were under the surface. And the only person you're being vulnerable with is yourself, which can be a lot easier than with someone else.
Wow. Firstly, thank you for being so open to talk about and share what you do and being vulnerable to everyone listening. I do really appreciate that.
Yeah, it's hard and it's very important. Hearing other people be vulnerable is like, oh, if they're allowed to do it, then maybe I'm allowed to do it too.
Exactly. 100%. And I think that as you were talking about the chair and video recording, immediately the first thing that came into my mind was the idea of self-love. And that's something that I've struggled with is I was journaling a few days ago and one of the prompts was like a reflection question. Are you showing yourself the same amount of compassion and love and understanding as you do other people? And for me, most of the time it's like, no, because I just go on autopilot and I'm so down on myself. Mm-hmm. And I wonder for you, I mean, as a person and maybe even as a small business owner, do you ever find yourself being very critical about what you do? Especially, I mean, in the garment industry, I can only imagine how perfect you want it to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah, self-criticism is still massive. Like, I, of course, deal with that all the time. And like working in and even like scheduling in self-compassion is a whole layer of its own effort. Like, I have to be really conscious of it. I'm super critical of myself and I catch myself doing it a lot. And I don't think that as humans, especially in our society, we can be completely free of that experience. We're social beings. We're comparing ourselves to other people, especially with social media where other people are putting their best foot forward online. You don't know the nuances or the challenges or the difficulties behind each photo that you're seeing, right? But I think a tool that has also helped me is being with other people and having a community and hearing them and what they're going through, and then knowing that they deserve compassion from me and the way that I offer them compassion, and thinking like, well, if I believe they deserve this kind of compassion, and I think that they're doing really good work and I'm proud of them, then why can't I feel that for myself in the same way? So I do ask myself this specific question, like, I want to treat this person this way. That is my intention. I also need to treat myself this way. And checking that takes a level of like consciousness and self-awareness to have that self-compassion, to have that patience. And like sitting back and like congratulating yourself on your actual achievements. Like, I did achieve this. I did accomplish this. Here's a list of things that I have done. And I need to sit here and I need to recognize myself for these things, because I have done all these things and they're incredible. And I'm impressed that I made it from January to June, for example. Like, give yourself a pat on the back, because it was really hard and you are still here. And like, maybe there are some failures along the way, but not every single thing can be a failure. And so you have to check in. You have to allow yourself to be proud of what you have done.
That's beautiful. The way you put it, it's like perfectly worded. And I think that's something that I need to remember as well. Now, I feel like shifting to kind of the other side of being a small business owner and an entrepreneur, I feel like what you said may can kind of sound like, not like negative, but kind of like downsounding. Like, these are kind of like the challenges. But what about the benefits? What is your favorite thing of being an owner, a small business owner?
I really love that when I come up with an idea, like, I am the source. I am the beginning stage or the beginning of step of like creating that into a reality. So it's fun when I'm like, I have an idea, and then seeing that idea through to whatever phase. Like, some ideas, they're just, I'm not going to come to fruition because it turns out they're not going to work out. And so that's, you got to like kill your baby sometimes. And that's like the whole process. Or even some ideas like, this is a great idea, but it is not, like, now is not the time. We have to sit on it. Maybe in 2 years or 6 months or 3 weeks or whatever is a better time for this idea to come through. I do love that. I think that is like the brilliance behind the creativity in entrepreneurship. And then the other thing that I really, really love is the connection with people. So my business has evolved from one type of business, like a service-based business and a client service-based business, to a business-to-business, essentially. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of work with people who are also makers, who also run their own businesses, who are in various phases of their business. And the connections and the conversations, like the one we're having right now, getting to talk to other people and their ideas and brainstorm how to move forward, how to adjust, how to build something great, how to make it better, how to, you know, imagine cash flow, AI things. I feel like AI, conversation about AI, and I'm like, it's like blowing up all over the internet. It's like, my feed's full of it. Like, now, which I think, is nuts.
I know. Like, every app I use has AI. The weather app I use, for some reason, has AI in it. I don't know what it's for, but it's just there.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just like the creative brain space, and then sharing that and being a part of that for other people and with other people is like so wonderful. I feel really grateful that that happens in my everyday. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are the things I like about.
That's amazing. Yeah, yeah. The one thing I love about, I mean, doing this podcast for myself is being able to talk to people and make those connections and make them meaningfully and authentically.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you mentioned community just a little while ago, and I wonder how important has having that circle of support, whether it be from family, friends, even other small business owners, how has that impacted your own success?
It is like the most important part. I've found, coming from a fashion background, when I was in school, and I think like a lot of historical companies, it's like been a bit of a rat race. Like there's like, mm-hmm. there's one spot and everyone's competing for that one spot, that one chance. And I always felt that felt really wrong or like incorrect for how I operated and what my values in life were. And so I've been like, you know, trying to figure out how can I live my life where I don't have to subscribe to that idea. But I love fashion. So how can I match these things? And it was a long time ago, someone once told me, and they were like, hairstylists, what happens with hairstylist businesses is they all congregate in the same pockets of the city. And mm-hmm. so when anyone ever needs to get their hair done, they all go to the same place. And instead of all the hair salons competing against each other, they're actually drawing greater numbers of clientele, and so they're mm-hmm. all benefiting from being together. Same way you kind of see how like maker markets operate. You have all of these vendors all in the same place. Everyone who goes to shop from all of them, they're not competing against each other, even though they may have similar things and they technically would qualify as competition. They're actually there helping each other make greater sales and to do better business because they're working mm-hmm. together. You can also see it. The great example is our textile stores. They're all in the same area. They're all in the textile district. There's literally mm-hmm. it in itself is evolving for different reasons, but like rent, which is a sad part about the city. But for example, for them to all be there together, they literally need each other to survive. And as stores are closing down and moving, the remaining stores, logistically, it can be more challenging for them to understand how to cater to their clientele when they can't cater to their clientele. They have nowhere else to send them to, and the mm-hmm. pressure on them, and they may not be able to like fill the orders, or the swarms of people shopping don't come in the same format anymore because it's so dispersed. They have to be selective of where they're going, these kinds of things. So when it comes to like community and talking to other business owners, how are you managing social media? Like some people are really successful in social media, but less understanding or successful in the operational systems management within their company, which like mm-hmm. those things are really, really important. How do you talk to someone who you see is doing a good job? How do you share that information? What's working for you and what's not working for you? Different industries. Certain ideas that can apply. Like I look at convenience stores and I'm like, that's not like my business, but they do some things that I think that could work for something like me. So let me go have a conversation and just like hear what I think might work or mm-hmm. maybe a suggestion. So coming up with these ideas on your own feels impossible and it's really lonely. And when you're stuck, how do you get out of it? You just need people to talk to. Mm-hmm. And abandoning that rat race mentality your ego is largely tied to it. Ego is a huge thing. And when you can kind of like let your ego go, you have such a great opportunity to flourish because the sense of competition isn't blocking you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Everyone's scratching each other's backs. We need each other. And like cross promotion, like even we have a bunch of makers who are in here and technically we're all in competition with each other, really. Like,
yeah.
We're all making products. We're all trying to have clients. We're all doing this. But the truth is that there's so much work going on and it's all unique and it's all different. All of us being together when we need to share projects with other people, all of us succeed just in proximity to each other. Community is everything.
Yeah, hearing that in the conference when we talked about that and the community was brought up, that was honestly one of the most shocking things to me, to hear you guys all agree on the fact that like you're all open to help each other and mention other people's names, repost content. And because to me, I always thought like, oh, like businesses, especially small businesses, it's going to be super competitive. It's like cutthroat and they want to keep everyone. But it made me feel like as a customer so much almost happier about it, the fact that you guys are lifting each other up, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's really a fascinating point when like once you participate in it and once you're like a member within that like structure of sharing,
mm-hmm.
how like immediate the benefits of it are. Like it seems like an impossible idea from the outside, right? I mean, I've definitely been in that place where like it is a rat race. Like, oh, how I can't share this other person's information because then I'm promoting someone else's business.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, once like the second you just start, you switch that mindset. It's really beautiful how opposite it operates from.
Yeah.
It's like, it's really beautiful. And even think like the algorithms on TikTok and Instagram are leaning more towards the sense of collaboration. So like mm-hmm. a big thing is like when you do the reaction videos to various TikToks or whatever, or mm-hmm. Like even I'll do other companies doing like sewing tutorials and I'll split screen and do the same one. Like the benefit of the sharing is very successful and companies like working together, collaborative event ideas, people love that stuff. I think people are so hungry for connection,
yeah,
that they'll take it in any format possible, and the internet is like also a big opportunity to consume.
Absolutely.
Yeah, collaboration, working together. It's cool this to be proven wrong. I love being proven.
I do want to say, take a small aside, your social medias, your Instagram, you guys are killing it.
Because I've been trying so hard.
It's hard.
Calling my friends, be like, what do I do? How do I social media? Please tell me what to do. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
The one thing I found in my own experiences with like reaching new audiences, is just use all 30 hashtags. Like max out.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah. I'm not sure if you do that.
Funny. I don't know what I'm doing with my hashtags. I'm also trying to be like authentic to the type of person I am, which is like,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to pretend I'm some version of something I'm not really.
Absolutely.
And so like my misspellings is like a big thing. I can't spell.
I see kind of some typos. I'm like, that's kind of a vibe though. I kind of like that. Yeah, I'm like it's real. It's not like, you know, like overproduced or anything. It's just like you're doing you.
Yeah.
So if that's what you're going for, it's crystal clear.
You're cool. Good. I'll keep up the spelling errors. Keep it human sounding. It's not AI, I promise. Unless AI starts learning how terrible of a speller I am, and then
oh, can you imagine it? I'll be crazy. Ask it to misspell things.
Honest, like maybe we shouldn't say that too loud because they're listening. Oh. Like a margin. I mean, I imagine like people submitting papers in the AI thing, like margin of error that proves it's a human versus a computer, like calculating, oh, there should be like 11% like grammatical errors or spelling errors.
Oh,
maybe I shouldn't have said that.
It's funny. My sister, she's a professor, and so she's had a couple of students who have like tried to turn in stuff with ChatGPT writing the whole report, and it's like you can just see it right away. It's just like, nope, that's not human.
Okay, good to know. I haven't used it yet, but I've been like, yeah, seeing a bunch of TikToks about it and like how to use the prompt.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, I'm like, it just sounds like you're asking another human a question. Like there's no staticness to the prompts. There's no, like even when I search something in Google, I'm usually like how to ABC.
Yeah.
And not like a casual linguistics of it, you know? Like, man, this is amazing.
It's honestly kind of shocking. Like you could type in like, I don't know, like make me a recipe for a chocolate cake and it'll do it in 2 seconds. Just draft you up.
I have to play around with this. I'm gonna make me sewing jokes.
That's so good. That is so good. Come on. Sewing jokes Saturdays.
More puns. AI puns.
Sewing jokes Saturdays, right there.
Oh, I love that. Okay. I'm gonna steal that. I'll credit you.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay, what was your original question? I think we went on like an AI tangent.
I have no idea, but that's okay. That's not a problem. Something I was wondering actually. So you're the first person I've ever talked to that's in the, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I've kind of classified the industry that you're in as like fashion garment alteration.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
And so I wonder like how fast paced is the industry in terms of changing with techniques or new machines and technology that you can use?
I think that there are areas that are moving really quickly, which is really exciting. And then there's a layer of like adaptation. You know, when, I would say like there's pockets that are like tech related. So like textile tech is like super cool. I love watching and learning like how laser printing textiles is going. It is so cool. But the adaptation and like en masse into like mass consumption, there's like a lot of physical steps in coming up with an idea and then mass manufacturing something and then putting it into like things like Walmart and stuff like that. So the fashion industry is very like nuanced and complex in terms of the scale in which companies want to operate in. So some things can move really quickly and then some things just move really, really slowly. And it's so diverse. But some things that don't change are like a lot of things have to be done by hand. Like we can laser print a shirt, but you can't really laser print. Maybe we can laser print shirts. You can like laser print chainmail.
So laser printing, is that like where you etch a design into like a piece of cloth? Is that what you're talking about?
Oh, laser printing, like you put it into CAD and then the like 3D printing is like, oh, laser print. Am I saying the wrong word?
It's like 3D printing is like
I'm thinking 3D printing.
Oh, okay.
Laser, right? I don't know. Well, anyway. 3D printing, you can like 3D print chainmail. You can probably 3D print a shirt.
That would be cool.
It would be really cool, but I don't know how like economical that choice is. You know what I mean? So interesting things like that. But yeah, like new machines and like robots sewing stuff. Yeah, all that stuff happens. But there's also a shift within like the garment manufacturing industry where so much of it is done overseas. There's so many issues with like fair labor laws and child labor and safety. There's this there's a lot of talk about like who made my clothes. You ever do search hashtag who made my clothes? I made my clothes. Or there's a lot of dark holes within the garment industry. On when you go to a store and you buy something, like is it like fair trade? Is it ethically made? Is it sustainable? A big thing is like water production and making t-shirts is like no bueno. There's a lot of issues within the garment industry, and the angle that we approach here is like the more local you do it, the more you know what's in your clothes, the more the more you can keep tabs on the ethics of what's going into something. And the higher value you hold for that piece and the longer it will exist and live. So if you've handmade your shirt, you're not going to throw it in the trash in 2 months like you would with something from like if you purchase a Forever 21 shirt or like
right.
shirt. It is going to be a higher quality piece. It's going to mean so much more to you. So your general footprint shrinks in terms of your environmental footprint. But that's like a new, it's a pretty new idea for a lot of people. In terms of their like shopping and understanding of how their wardrobe plays into their general sustainability initiatives. Yeah, that's just like one angle. But also I think the pandemic put a lot of pressure. You couldn't order things, you couldn't get things.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But then Amazon takes off and you can literally still buy anything from anywhere.
Yeah.
Tomorrow. Just like, it's like stuff is happening over here, but then other stuff is happening over here. I don't know.
Yeah.
Some pockets slowing down and some pockets speeding up. Yes and no.
I've been so spoiled, and I'm sure so many other people have as well, by Amazon's Prime Delivery. Okay. And that basically instant gratification, and I don't like it because it makes me like, like the fact that the shipping time of like a day versus 4 to 5 business days is a factor in me wanting to buy something, especially from local businesses who maybe can't ship it out that fast. I don't like that.
It's a massive barrier for local businesses for sure. Like I haven't really been in a lot of conversations with people about like what's happening, like how are you creatively combating this, this phenomenon that's happening essentially. It's like a type of shopping, it's a type of consumption.
Yeah.
Is brand new. You know, this did not exist however many years ago. And now that it does exist, like it's a new problem. The whole pivot thing. Like
yeah.
The environment, the landscape of which we have operated has changed. How do we adjust to work differently? Yeah, and I think like maybe human connection is a really big part of how that change. Lack of contact with people in that format is a massive factor, which a lot of people like that part also. So it's like, I don't know, what do you do? I'm not sure. Yeah, the convenience of having things arrive. I know.
Yeah.
I'm guilty of it too. Yeah. I don't know. I wish I had
the answers.
Like wishing like, oh, the answer is just like magic dust in the air and then people just change their minds about stuff. Anyway, no.
I'm really curious as to what your thoughts are, and this is a bit of a two-parter question. Your thoughts on fast fashion and like H&M and all those things and Shein. And may have forgotten the second part of my two-parter, but we'll say that for now. So just your thoughts on fast fashion as somebody who's in the clothing space.
Yeah, fast fashion the logistics of fast fashion are just not sustainable. They have been sustainable for a long time, and I think they make the top people a lot of money. There's a lot of money to be made in how the profit margins have been arranged. But for people at the very top to make a lot of profit, there are people along the bottom who are the ones really spending. The cost lands on them, and that's often the manufacturers, a lot of fast fashion, some of the design houses even, they like employ designers, like even people graduating from, you know, TMU in the design program, making like barely livable wages to live, you know, and like a quote unquote exciting, sexy fashion job.
Yeah.
And people like manufacturing and actually doing like the hands-on labor, delivery, textile, dyeing. There's a lot of people touching each item that you purchase. A lot of people are touching it. Like maybe over 100 different people will touch the item before it even gets in your hands. And they're all paying a cost for you to spend $4 to have it in your possession. And the scale of production, this sheer scale, because it's all an economy of scale, right? The more company manufacturers and the millions, the lower the price per unit will be. So if you buy something for $4, that means there's like 1 million other of these things that are out built in the world. And what happens when 1 million people don't care about this thing that you just purchased anymore? Where does it go? And it ends up in our ocean. Really, what ends up happening is it just goes into the ocean. So I think like recognizing that that is the big picture of these fast fashion companies, and like is some angles of exploitation that's happening, whether that's human exploitation, economic exploitation, class exploitation, and environmental exploitation. Just those are my thoughts on it.
Yeah. I mean, the main thing for me, like, so I was, I would say I made the mistake of buying from Shein in the pandemic when it was really popular. And I bought like a shirt for like $3. And as soon as I hit confirm my order, I just was, I had so much regret. Because I'm like, a $3 shirt, like, how ethical is it really? And the quality wasn't the best either, I'll be honest. Yeah, that's kind of what I thought of, especially as you were saying what you were saying. So I'm like, it's a $3 shirt. It can't really be made well. And when you said 100 people, my face was kind of like disgust because I don't like germs. So I thought like 100 different hands touching it. And I'm like, oh, no, thank you.
I mean, like, yeah, whatever version of like affects you. I think an important thing that we also need to tie in is like on this topic of sustainability and like operating as a person in our society. And we live in a city, things are available to us. We are like a certain like socioeconomical space. Like the choice to participate and not participate in what is like sort of normal in our circles. I think it's like being aware of what you're choosing, but then also like giving yourself a pass at times as well. Like we cannot be 100% the most flawless, perfect humans ever. Yeah. Like we are human. We do have to operate within whatever's happening around us in some capacity. But like, don't beat yourself up. Like I do buy things from Amazon, and I went to the dollar store and I had to buy all these things from the dollar store. The dollar store is like also terribly convenient and amazing, but also terrible. So it's like clocking the amount of consumption and your participation in consumption, and capitalism. I think it's a balance. Like you want, you have to participate, because not to participate, then you kind of fall behind in a lot of ways. But then you don't want to participate too much. So it's like a balance of like compassion and consideration and like maybe you don't do it all the time. Maybe you're not like a number one Shein consumer.
Yeah. You
know? But like, don't beat yourself up, essentially, is what I mean to tell you and anyone else buying those kinds of
definitely
products. But it's also in the proof is in the pudding. Like, it was not a very good product.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you're like, well, maybe I don't really buy from here because I know it's going to be shit and I'll actually just save my money in the long run and I'll buy the good pair of shoes. I just won't buy six shoes. I'll buy one really good pair and they'll actually last me 10 years. And funny enough, it came from the person making them literally down the street.
Yeah.
Actually nice was that. And now I know. So.
Yeah. Thank you for adding that. That was definitely very important to add and very beautifully worded. That's something that's important to hear. All about that balance.
It is. Balance. Yeah. Balance is everything. Yeah.
You need definitely.
You can't have the good without the bad. Mm-hmm. You can't know what's bad unless you have the good. So. Yeah, just clock the good bad.
That was profound right there. I like that. That was good. Yeah. So the second part of my question, I remember it. It's how do you stay up to date with all the trends and current fads in fashion? And how do you apply that to your own work, if you do?
This is a good question. I feel like I don't keep up to date. I don't really seek it out. And I think historically with my tailoring history, I've leaned much more into the personal and individual experience. Because I find that like I exist and I cater to pockets of people that are on pathways of self-discovery, and a lot of the time it is not the I don't know, necessarily like the status quo or like what everyone else is doing. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of style, I would say color is like a style thing. That can like really, it reaches every single different type of industry. So WGSN is, I don't know, they're like color forecasters. There's a group of people, they choose the colors and what's going to be fashionable for this year, next year. And
it's just a group. It's just like a one group that does that.
Pretty much. It's like, there's like a little bit of like forecasting science and stuff to it for sure.
Okay.
But yeah, it was essentially like, like the Illuminati of color.
So that's like for like the summer color palette, like that would be the main group that like decides, oh, this is what's going to be for summer and what people should follow.
Kind of. It's a little,
maybe it's a little more than that, but
it is, it's much more complicated than that. But essentially, yeah, there are people that like help decide like, okay, these are going to be like Pantone XY00, whatever. And so then it'll be like, they'll send that all to people observing these, like the textile makers and like the paint makers and the car industry and any industry really, be like, okay, well, we're preparing the next 4 years. So we want to create things that
are
also amazing. Cause it's all like people are sheep, right? So when you see a cool color come out and you see that color, turns out it's like a lot of other places. You're like, wow, I love this color. You've been told you love this color by the industry.
Wow.
You know? So they're all talking to each other. But in terms of forecasting and trends and style and stuff like that, like how I talk to my individual clients and what kind of work I do with them is like really on like an emotional level of like, what do you like about yourself? And why do you like these things about yourself? And how do you like to be spoken to? And what does that mean for how you like your shirts to fit? And like finding those, like the bridges in that. And encouraging people to abandon being told what's good and having to fit that. And then being a little more self-selective of like, well, what feels good? What actually feels good for me? And maybe there's a decade that where the fashion was like, you know, really them and they like really feel themselves in this way. So like, what is trend? What is style? Really, what is like personal recognition and identity in that?
Wow. I love that. I've gone to a tailor maybe like once or twice before. And it, for me, it was like the complete opposite of what you're trying to create in the environment, where it was like, I felt almost like I couldn't really share like how I wanted whatever the suit pants to fit, because I had to fit this like narrative or what it should be. So I really love that. From what I'm hearing, it's like creating that safe space to be open and really focus on the your own needs as a customer and as a person.
Yeah. Yeah. I like making people feel really good about themselves. And like, you know, how can you really feel like confident out and about if you don't feel like the message, essentially your clothing is a message of who you are and what you represent mm-hmm. and what you're saying, right? It's like a silent billboard.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of. And if you don't feel comfortable, if you don't feel right in it, how can you be the most optimal version of yourself? And like so many people in like the communities that we serve face that issue. Like mm-hmm. It is wrong inside this like shell. And so it isn't about changing what's inside the shell. It's about changing what the shell is, which is like the actual threads on your body. To match what's on the inside. Honestly, like breaks my heart when I hear that tailors don't offer that kind of safe space, because I feel like the same way you get your hair cut, you go, they learn every detail about your life. They want you to, they're like, your hairstylist is often your therapist, your secondary therapist. They're doing a lot of emotional labor. That's why your haircut costs so much money.
Yeah.
There you go.
I believe it.
$140 on like your highlights or $200, whatever amount of money it is, you're literally paying for therapy. That's what you're doing. But I think the tailoring experience is a lot like that too, because it is so essential to how you walk through life and how people see you and how they perceive mm-hmm. you. And you want to feel good about it. Everyone wants to feel good about themselves. Fashion, compassion.
Amazing. And so I just have two more questions here. And these ones, I feel like they're a little bit, I don't know. I won't preface that with saying anything like they're, but my question is, how do you define success, whether it be personal or professional?
It's a good question. I would say it's like quite hard.
Mm-hmm.
Define success. And I think the perception of other people onto you, their definition of your success is also very different, because they don't always know what it feels like. Mm-hmm. Success for me, I would say, is like a little bit of a two-parter. Like financially, feeling secure, I think, is like a checkpoint of success for me. Which like the ebb and flow of that is a journey. So I think like, yeah, financial stability and security, I would say that. And then like accomplishments, like things that I have created and done that have had impact, and that people feel are like memorable. And they're excited to continue to talk about those things. So I have felt really successful in a couple points. Like when I throw a really fun event and someone has really enjoyed participating and attending, and they have themselves created something special from being there. I feel very successful when I get feedback of, I had so much fun. I met so many cool people. I made this really cool thing. I'm so proud of myself. Look what I sewed. I feel super successful when I've had such a positive impact on someone. And then I felt really successful when I put myself out there for being really brave, when I've done something really, really brave and really scary. And I passed through it and I made it through to the other side. And I made the best of what that was. Like, I was on like I'm really proud of this show. I was on a reality TV show, and I was
really
It was a design competition show. It was called Stitched, and it was back in 2018. And it was really, really fun. It was terrifying, like the whole like application process and putting in a reel and then auditions, and it was like, ooh, so nerve-wracking. And then the show itself was like a whole whirlwind. But then I ended up winning, and I won a bunch of money, which was super cool. And it just felt like all of the bravery that I had to have all the way through, and then seeing it to the other side, and also having like evidence that it happened, was also really cool. And throwing various like fashion events, I threw a really big like zombie fashion show back when I was in university. It was a big
success.
And it was like, yeah, it was just like cool that I did it, pulled it off. Me and my friend put it on together. Yeah, things like this. I think like, yeah, having impact on other people, that has been really positive. Even if like the financial part of those kinds of things doesn't necessarily come to fruition, but knowing that the emotional and mental impact it had on inspiring other people does feel like the work that I've done is important.
That's amazing. Well, firstly, congratulations on your win.
Yeah, I like honestly really want to do more reality TV. So if anyone wants me to be on their reality show, please call me. It was so much fun. And anyway, I would totally do it again.
No, I'm so curious. I always watch reality shows. Like, I'm watching Love is Blind right now, the newest season. And so how real is what they show on TV?
I would say like it's like all heavily edited. Like they'll take like bits and pieces of the narrative that's going on, and they'll put it together for like juicy, digestible, and consumptionable content, right? They're just taking a lot of footage and then splicing some stuff together. So there's like an opportunity for it to not be authentic. And then there's probably leaning into a lot of the authenticness too.
Yeah.
So grain of salt, people, you know, all the people on the show, they're also creating their own, essentially actors' reels. So now they're like in the scope of film and television, right? So
yeah,
they may be putting on a bit of an act.
Yeah.
Maybe not. I don't know. I don't know if I would go on a show like that. I don't think like the purpose of it is really necessarily something I need, but the competition shows. Ooh, there was one show I really wanted to do. I can't remember what it's called. It was like the Ugly Baking Show.
I love it.
Remember that one? Nailed it.
I love Nailed It. Oh so my good. God.
Oh, that show I totally, totally would do. Yeah.
That would be so cool.
So I'm hoping maybe that show will come up again. I'll
send a little application in. You never know.
Nailed It for Fashion. Host that show here.
That would be dope.
If anybody wants to host a reality show at Shop and Taylor Studios, please call me immediately. We'll make it happen.
Same day. Happens same day.
Yeah, Hot Glue Express. I consider that selling.
I love it.
Staples, yeah. Oh, that would be awesome.
That's a project right there. I would pay to watch it. I'll let you know right now.
Excellent. Yeah, I just need a producer to call me. And anyway.
How was it having all the cameras in front of you?
Kind of funny. Like, I would say I was like so in the zone. The logistics of the show was like there's like three challenges and you had X amount of time to execute each fashion thing you were making.
Okay.
So the time was like tight and I had to like work so fast and so hard. So it was like blinders on, like operate quickly. And then they would prompt you like, Would you mind just saying we have 20 minutes left? And then I have to like pretend we had 20 minutes left. This kind of stuff. But like, I didn't even notice the camera sometimes because I was just so focused on working so quickly. Mm-hmm. But at one point they had this like pretty cool, it was like a big arm. So like a massive arm with like a camera on the end of it. And it just like scoops around and does this like, in the space, but I wouldn't notice it was there. And then I would look up and it would be like right in my face. Like, oh shit. Which is kind of fun. But I just felt like the staff and the crew, like the hospitality crew and all the people working were like a family. And it really felt like all the camera people just felt like, I don't know, like the cousin at the dinner table sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It felt like I was invited to a big old family like cookout. And then
that's awesome.
It was very welcoming. It was really nice.
That's cool. Did you have to do those like, I guess, mid-show interviews where it's just you and the camera?
Yeah.
Okay, where did you look?
So what they do is like, so they have their camera and then there's like a selection of crew that are like helping with whatever. And then they have their backdrop and you sit in the chair, whatever they've designed. Mm-hmm. And then the interviewer sits beside the camera. So you're not talking into the camera, you're talking next to the camera.
Yeah.
They're very good. They're very, very good at how to ask you questions, how to dig into stuff. I only imagine like, you know, the dating reality shows, the like the interviewer has to be like amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're just like digging in, stirring the pot, ruffling feathers, you know? Anyway, I just have like a lot of mad respect for people who work on reality TV because it's just like a lot of people doing a lot of jobs, creating a lot of things to happen. It's cool.
Yeah, honestly, I never thought about the fact that reality TV as, what's the right word? I don't want to, okay, well, maybe this, I'll say trashy just for the sake of it. How trashy it can be at times, but the fact that it's still television, you know, it's still a whole production, it's still everything. So, it's a very interesting thing to be reminded of.
Yeah, I feel like I'm kind of like new to the reality. I used to think the same thing because I think like originally reality TV was just a lot of people's like trashy drama and just on camera, which like serves its kind of purpose, right? But now it's like there's a finesse and an art to it that is. It's fat, like the psychology of like how people are so obsessed and addicted to it. It's interesting, just like the psychology of it. But I think they always say it comes down to the editing. Like the editors are like, like reality TV. They're the stars. They're the real stars.
I will say I have some beef with the Netflix editors. And I mean this in the most constructive way, of course. But for Love is Blind, they will cut out so many chunks. I don't know if you've watched any of the seasons.
I stopped after season 2. I haven't watched any more since season 2.
Okay. But so I don't know if you noticed this, but they're like the conversation will actually start getting juicy and it's like an honest conversation between two people. But then they just cut it out and then they go bye-bye and they leave.
Yeah. Yeah, and they have to keep the suspense.
And that's the issue. I'm like, I want to hear more about this stuff. Over.
Can't even
get
the show's over.
It's awful. I mean, I guess, to keep the show running, but it's like, keeping me on the edge of a cliff and I don't like it.
But you keep coming back for more, don't you?
I talked to my girlfriend. I said, I do not want to watch the fourth season because after the third season, it was just, I was emotionally drained. My heart was shattered. It was a lot. But then last night we watched the first episode of the fourth season. And it's really good. It's really good.
Abusive relationship.
Exactly. I have a toxic relationship with reality shows and I'm not afraid to admit it.
The first step is admitting it.
That's right. Exactly. So I'm on the way to recovery. That's good.
Yeah, you should check out Housewives, the Housewives series. Danger. Oh,
that's dangerous right there. to me that's like the quintessential reality series right there.
I got really into reality TV in the pandemic because I wasn't allowed to see anyone, right? But like the destruct the social structures of reality TV kind of operated similarly to how, as close to social interaction as I was really getting, really.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I like by proxy felt like these people on TV were my friends because I was in on the drama.
Yeah.
But chaos, total chaos.
Yeah. But I totally relate to that. Like, I understand that. But my thing has always been cooking shows. I love those. Mm-hmm. That's where it's at. Like all the chopped, I don't even know what other ones. Whatever Gordon Ramsay's in, that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Hell's Kitchen? Is it Hell's Kitchen?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like, also the hilarity of him because he's so, like, loud and angry and crazy on screen, but then he's just, like, a lovely man in real life.
I know.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen, like, the parallels between him with adult chefs and him with kid chefs?
No. I don't think I've actually watched him with his kid, like, kids shows, but I watch him in his fam, like, his family on, like, TikTok.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love it.
Oh, nice.
I know. Like, he seems like I want to be his friend. And then I go into the kitchen and he's screaming at me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think my last question, though, and this is something I love to do because I'm going to flip it back onto you. And I want to ask you if you have any questions for me about anything that we talked about today or beyond.
What are your goals with your podcast? What do you want? Where do you want to see it in like a year, 6 months, 2 weeks?
That's good. I like it. Okay. This is going to be manifesting it and making a note of it right here. Okay. So thank you for the question, by the way. That is a really thoughtful question. I see it at least long term. I mean, it'd be super cool if this could become, you know, a job of some kind that brings an income, whether it be my main income or a side one, that's whatever, but I'm not really thinking about it like that. It's a cool hobby. But just, I kind of want it to be a platform that grows where people can listen and feel like they're a part of the conversation, even though they're not there, whether it's like while they're walking, you know, commuting, studying, whatever. I want this to be like a place where people can find comfort.
Yeah.
And kind of like you were saying with reality shows, come in and feel like they're having that social interaction without necessarily being around people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think in 2 weeks, a super short term is just to not get burnt out by it. Because I made the mistake of like scheduling a lot of guests back to back to back to back for multiple days. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I did this week. Yeah. So it's just to get through it and not make that mistake again.
It's a learning curve, right? Now you yeah. know what that feels like and you can adjust and adapt moving forward.
Yeah,
cool. That's good. What would be what's something that you want to say to your listeners who aren't in this particular conversation, but to invite them in as like a silent participant?
Wow. That is legitimately an exceptional question. Okay. What would I tell people to come in to be a part of to listen in? Oh, I mean, you know, come on and listen if you just want to hear people talk, honestly. Mm-hmm. That's what this is all about, just highlighting people's stories, highlighting people's journeys, and really just kind of breaking away from the like podcasts that talk to celebrities, because to me that's always kind of out of touch. I can't relate to how people, you know, are on vacation in Bali or whatever. That's not me.
If
you want, if you want a more honestly like real conversation about life, positives, negatives, people's struggles and successes, mm-hmm. that's the place to be.
Yeah, much closer to home. Like I'm not very far removed from most people.
Just yeah.
walking on the street. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the whole thing.
That's cool.
I love it. Thank you.
Yeah.
And so actually I did have one more question. I will say, and this is kind of to finish it off. If you could give one piece of advice to yourself when you were starting back years back with the business, or to anybody who's looking to enter the fashion space or even have their own small business, what would that piece of advice be?
I'm going to say, so this, my friend said this to me, and I've kind of alluded to this a little bit throughout our conversation today, but my friend gave me this piece of advice, and I do say it a lot, and it's, you don't know what's on the other side of 5 seconds of bravery. And so be brave. Be brave. Just continue to be brave. And you will see what comes from that. And it will be, your bravery will be fruitful in whatever format that it presents itself to you.
I love it. That's fantastic. Yeah. Megan, thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy Monday. Thanks. I really appreciate it.
It was a really wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed these questions.
It was. Thank you. That warms my heart. I'm really happy. I'm glad. And to everyone else listening, I hope you all have an amazing day, an amazing afternoon, evening, or night, and have a great rest of your week.
And sit and reflect on what you've done that has made you proud today and that you feel has been a success of the day for yourself.
I was just going to say, show yourself some self-compassion.
Yeah.
Get it. Bye, everybody.
Very good.